The Religion of Art by Sangharakshita. Art and religion overlap. Just as there is in religion an element which is aesthetic, so there is also in art a constituent which is religious. In these days, when the decay of religious belief has led to the decline of that part of religion which is also a province of art, it might be possible, by developing the implications of that part of art which is also a province of religion, to promote a way of life dedicated to the realization of values in a manner attractive to those who are only repelled when it is presented to them from a formally religious point of view. It might even be possible to inaugurate for such people a religion of art. By the religion of art, we do not mean the use of art as one of the substitutes for religion in the Huxleyan sense. Just as there are some things belonging to religion which have nothing to do with art, so also there are many things of much importance to art which have no place in religion. The coincidence between the areas of these two spheres of human activity is partial, not complete. Some religion is some art, and some art some religion. All religion is not all art. Mr. Huxley makes it clear that while he uses the word religion in the fuller sense, that includes an aesthetic constituent, the term art is used in the narrower sense that excludes any element of religion. Art without religion is set up as one of the substitutes of religion with art. Although admitting that, quote, to minds whose religious needs have been denied their normal fulfilment, art brings a certain spiritual satisfaction, unquote, the author of the penetrating essay on the substitutes for religion is not blind to the fact that, quote, where beauty is worshipped for beauty's sake as a goddess, independent of and superior to morality and philosophy, the most horrible putrefaction is apt to set in, unquote. And he concludes his section on the artistic substitute with the caustic observation, quote, the lives of the aesthetes are the far from edifying commentary on the religion of beauty, unquote. The horrible putrefaction which ensues when art is sundered from religion and metaphysics was the subject of a poem written almost a century earlier than Huxley's essay. In The Palace of Art, Tennyson has described with his usual abundance of vivid pictorial detail the fate of a glorious devil, large in heart and brain, that did love beauty only, and who had therefore planned to devote his life to the solitary enjoyment of whatever masterpieces of painting, music and poetry had been produced by man. Historically speaking, the poem is prophetic of the aesthetic movement which was to spring up in the latter half of the 19th century, and which was to flower most gorgeously and most corruptly during the decade preceding the arrest and conviction of Oscar Wilde, when the dew was abruptly shaken from the black rose and the wasp-bodied butterflies rudely scattered from their green carnations. Psychologically, it is an eternally true study of the feelings of dissatisfaction and frustration into which a life of self-indulgence, even aesthetic self-indulgence, eventually disintegrates. At the beginning of the poem, the glorious devil is described as building for his soul a lordly pleasure house wherein at ease for aye to dwell, and is reported as inviting her to make merry and carouse. She is to live alone in her high palace, indifferent to what is happening in the world outside, and caring nothing for the joys and sorrows of men. Indeed, to her fastidious taste, the uncultured commonalty appears no better than darkening droves of swine, and with a little delicate shudder of disgust, she watches them as they graze and wallow, breed and sleep. But the day of retribution is at hand. The opium-eater's dream lasts but for 3 short years. In the 4th year, tormented by despair and doubt, she begins to loathe solitude and to hate herself. The pleasure house becomes her prison. Remorse scorches her like fire. And at the conclusion of the poem, she abandons her palace for a cottage in the valley where she can mourn and pray. She begs her master not to pull down her palace towers, which have been so lightly and beautifully built. It was not art that was at fault. but the soul's misuse of art. When she has purged her guilt, she says, perhaps it will be possible for her to return there and dwell, not alone, but this time in the company of other people. Though The Palace of Art is a poem, and not a treatise or on ethics or an excursus into psychology, the moral which emerges from its dreamlike sequence of brilliant word pictures is almost nakedly apparent, and has in fact been stated explicitly in the dedication which Tennyson prefixed to the poem. He that shuts out love from his life shall in turn be shut out from love, and on her threshold lie howling in outer darkness. This is the sentence of what Buddhists would call karma, not blind fate or destiny, but that reaction of one's own action whereby the justice of the universe is asserted and the equilibrium of nature restored. By love is not meant a meaty acquaintance or a jealous emotional preference, but that spirit of self-abnegation, that entire absence of selfish desires, which is the beginning and end of every virtue, the base and crown of all spirituality, and which, according to Dante, is so mighty that it moves the sun in heaven and all the stars. Though at a high stage of spiritual development it may be possible to speak with Rilke of love without the beloved, for most of us this emotion, like the rest, can be achieved only through our association with other men and women. The aesthete shuts out love from his life because he shuts out people, because his soul dwells alone unto herself, indulging in the refined selfishness of artistic pleasures. The sin he commits, the guilt which in the end he feels he must purge away, is the primal sin of attachment to one's separate selfhood. He finds to his horror that the much vaunted doctrine of art for art's sake is reversed in practice and becomes, though probably in a sense different from that intended by Lawrence, art for my sake. He discovers that he has failed to distinguish what have been called the pleasures of poetry, which first satisfy, then satiate, and finally disgust the soul, from the ardours of poetry, by which the soul is quickened, purified, and in the end liberated from the bondage of its own separateness. It is regarding works of art as an amusement, or employing them merely as a means of egoistic pleasure, that constitutes the distinguishing feature of art as one of the substitutes of religion. The religion of art, on the contrary, views the creation and enjoyment of paintings, musical compositions, and poems as primarily a means of liberation from the egoistic life, and looks upon beauty as one of the three great initiators into the mysteries of the life of egolessness. But before attempting to gain a clear understanding of the nature of the religion of art, we must first of all examine separately the meaning of religion and the meaning of art. No one who has attempted to reduce into a semblance of order the swarm of indistinct ideas and confused emotions which cluster about religion can have failed to be struck by the vagueness and ambiguity of this protean word. Like the apostle to the Gentiles, it has endeavoured to be all things to all men, but instead of meaning something to everybody, it has now come perilously near to meaning nothing to anybody. In so thick an obscurity, indeed, has the word now become involved that Mr. Aldous Huxley, who introduces his collection of substitutes for religion with a description of what he calls the genuine article, very wisely refrains from attempting a formal definition of religion, remarking, quote, such definitions are mostly so vague and abstract as to be almost meaningless, unquote. Instead of a definition, he gives, quote, a catalogue of the principal states of mind and actions recognized as religious, together with a brief account of the most characteristic features of the religious doctrines, which are the rationalizations of these states and acts, unquote. But recognized as religious by whom, one may pertinently inquire. Most characteristic from what point of view, or in the eyes of which observer? A description which highlights certain details of an object at the expense of certain others can be almost as misleading as a definition which submerges all alike in the double darkness of abstraction and generalization. though not untrue, it does not tell the whole truth, and is therefore not wholly true. Moreover, description and definition cannot be divorced so absolutely as Mr. Huxley's remarks appear to suggest. Definition is always of a specific thing, which has been isolated for the purpose from the multiplicity of other things in the midst of which it exists. The isolation of a highly complex phenomenon like religion is impossible without some criterion of which elements are to be excluded and which are not. In other words, you cannot describe a thing unless you have first of all at least some knowledge of what is to be described. No description of religion can be attempted without formulating a provisional definition of the nature of religion. Such a provisional definition does in fact lurk somewhere at the back of Mr. Huxley's mind and betrays its presence as soon as he talks about rationalisation. Far from casting over the religions of the world a glance of Olympian impartiality, all that he offers us is a view of the subject which is a squint with selective prejudice. However, some of the characteristics he describes are undoubtedly characteristics of religion from the standpoint of the religion of art, and we shall therefore examine them one by one in the hope that this procedure will enable our own definition of the word to emerge with greater clearness. The description of the genuine article, which he has given in this essay, certainly will be in any case more helpful to us than his researches in more recent years, which have extracted from the diversity of religious beliefs a highest common factor as vague and abstract as the most impenitent intellectual even could wish for. First in the Huxleyan catalogue is, quote, a sense of awe in face of the mysteries and immensities of the world, unquote, which, he supposes, quote, is the most fundamental religious state of mind, unquote. The definition of religion implicit in his mind has already set in motion the machinery of selection, and by the time we have recovered from the jolt, it is grinding away vigorously. Quote, this feeling is rationalized in the form of belief in supernatural beings, both kindly and malevolent, as is the world in which men live. Unquote. The wheels are now fairly whizzing round. Quote, in the higher religions, the rationalization is very elaborate and constitutes an account, complete and coherent, of the whole universe. Unquote. The ambiguity of the word fundamental, which can be understood in a historical, psychological, or metaphysical sense, may be overlooked. What cannot be overlooked is the incompleteness of the facts whereon the generalization is based, and the consequent precariousness of an explanation reared on such a slender foundation. Like almost all generalizations about religion, it ignores completely that vast area of belief and practice designated Buddhism. A sense of awe in face of the mysteries and immensities of the world is not the fundamental Buddhist state of mind in any sense of the word. Awe is a species of fear. And the fundamental Buddhist state of mind is not one of fear, but of complete freedom from fear. All fear is basically hatred of death, just as every kind of hope is essentially desire for life. Desire and hatred, attraction and repulsion, are rooted in the ego sense, in the false conception that the word self denotes an unchanging entity separate from all other selves. The fundamental Buddhist state of mind is a state of freedom from fear because it is also a state of freedom from the ego sense. When the Buddha, before his enlightenment, experienced a panic, fear and dread while dwelling alone in the terror-haunted jungle, so that the hair rose bristling on his scalp, he did not rationalize the feeling, as according to Mr. Huxley he ought to have done, but remained where he was until he had subdued and conquered it. This spirit of heroic valour, firm and unmoved, he not only breathed himself, but inspired into the hearts of his disciples, and exercises for the control of fear have remained through the centuries an integral part of Buddhist spiritual practice. It is hardly reasonable to explain the beliefs of a religion as rationalizations of an emotion which it does its utmost to subjugate. Even a teaching that has suffered as much as Buddhism has from the misrepresentations of critics would not expect to be treated so unfairly. Though references to supernatural beings, both kindly and malevolent, do occur in the Tripitaka quite frequently, their occurrence cannot be regarded as a manifestation of awe in the face of natural phenomena on the part of the compilers of the sacred volumes. Without necessarily asserting the non-existence of supernatural beings, a dogma which appears to be one of the 39 articles of modern scientific belief, we would point out that such beings occupy an entirely subordinate position on the mythological fringe of Buddhism, so that even if their objective existence were definitely disproved, the basic truths of the Dharma would remain unshaken. Indeed, it could be argued with considerable plausibility that the devas, yakshas, and other species of non-human beings who from time to time make their appearance in Buddhist apologue and anecdote are the rationalizations of the fears not of the Buddha and his disciples, but of the peoples of pre-Buddhist India. The argument seems to be strengthened by the fact that even Mara, the chief of the malevolent beings, is never represented as a really dangerous or even formidable antagonist of the Buddha. He is a mischievous rather than an evil spirit, and totally lacks the dignity and grandeur of Milton's rebel angel. His wickedness vents itself by playing petty tricks and giving small annoyances. It does not explode in cosmic disaster or entail universal ruin. Like the emotions of which he and his myrmidons are supposed to be rationalizations, he is rendered harmless as soon as he is recognized, and has no refuge from ignominious punishment other than equally ignominious flight amid the laughter of the arahants who are the witnesses of his discomfiture. Ridicule is a powerful solvent of fear, and the fact that they could laugh at the silly, blundering wickedness of poor Mara shows that those early Buddhists were not afraid of him. Perhaps it shows that they no longer really believed in his existence. The position occupied by the Prince of Darkness in the Pali scriptures is far from enviable. After all, it is not easy to tempt or frighten those who insist upon regarding you as a piece of obsolete psychology or as an out-of-date literary convention. Buddhism could, we suppose, without exaggerating its own importance, claim to rank among those higher religions to which Mr. Huxley's selective machinery rattles out a reference. But the inclusion serves only to make the uniqueness of the Dharma still more strikingly evident. Far from obediently towing the line which Mr. Huxley draws for the higher religions, and advancing a rationalization of the feeling of awe so very elaborate that it constitutes, quote, an account complete and coherent of the whole universe, unquote, Buddhism withdraws into a position so aloof from that occupied by all other religions that some of them even consider it as no more belonging to their company. If interrogated on the subject, it would agree, having in fact maintained the principle for 25 centuries, that complete and coherent accounts of the universe were, if not all the direct outcome of fear, certainly at bottom the joint product of egoistic craving and ignorance. Indeed, being nothing if not practical, it would go much further than this and insist that all such accounts, ditti or views in its own terminology, must be abandoned if ever the mind is to attain to a condition of absolute freedom. Buddhism is a method of resolving the disharmonies of life. In the oft-recurring formula of the sacred books, it teaches only suffering and the cessation of suffering. It is not science, so that it has nothing to say concerning the origin of the material universe. It is not philosophy in the merely speculative or academic sense, so that it is silent on metaphysical differences which do not, in William James' expressive phrase, make a difference. It is not religion in the Huxleyan connotation of the term, because it not only fails to rationalize feelings of awe into a belief in good and evil spirits, but also refrains from elaborating them into a systematic explanation of the universe. Buddhism proclaims not merely freedom from fear, but also freedom from religion. For religion is based on fear. Needless to say, the belief in a personal creator God, which occupies a central position in all other higher religions, is regarded by Buddhism as simply a more ambitious and therefore a more harmful result of the same process of rationalisation, which, at the other end of the scale, was responsible for the production of poor Mara. Diabolus Deus Inversus Est. Indeed, Brahma cuts in the Pali scriptures a figure no less ridiculous than that of his infernal counterpart, and for precisely the same reason. The fear of the Lord is, according to Buddhism, not the beginning of wisdom, but the crown of folly. True wisdom cannot be attained until fear, in all its forms, has been conquered. What more effective means of dissipating this particular fear of the Lord could there be than the delicate mockery of the Pali scriptures? The second item in Mr. Huxley's catalogue of the principal states of mind and actions recognised as religious is ritual. The religious feeling, he says, quote, finds its active as opposed to its intellectual expression in the form of propitiatory ritual. Ritual, as soon as it is invented, occupies a position of prime importance in all religions, for the rite evokes by associations those emotions of awe which are, for the individual who feels them, the God himself. And these emotions are accompanied by others no less exhilarating, and therefore no less divine. Chief among these is what may be called the social emotion, the feeling of excitement caused by being in a crowd. Unquote. Once again, we are made aware of the enormous discrepancy between Buddhism and other religions. Gods and demons are, according to Mr. Huxley, rationalizations of fear, and this feeling of fear is, as we have seen, absent from the representatively Buddhist mind. Yet, ignoring this fact, he rushes into a generalization to which, as the most elementary manual of Buddhism would have informed him, there is at least one very important exception, and sweepingly asserts that rituals for the propitiation of gods and demons occupy, quote, a place of prime importance in all religions, unquote, among which it must be supposed he intends to include Buddhism. Let it be said at once that although such rituals are known in most Buddhist lands, and indeed are upon occasions resorted to by most Buddhists, they are merely survivals of primitive beliefs which have been affiliated to Buddhism, and in no sense form part of the original Dharma of the Buddha, which, as we have already observed, on the contrary, confines itself to resolving the disharmonies of life, to the attainment of a state of mind, usually designated nirvana, whence fear and all other egocentric emotions have been prescinded. Buddhist religious feeling finds its active as opposed to its intellectual expression not in propitiatory ritual, but in the practice of ethics, sila, concentration, samadhi, and intuitive wisdom, prajna. In following the Noble Eightfold Path, which leads to arahantship, and in cultivating the 10 perfections of the Bodhisattva. It is a stranger to exhilarating emotions of the Dionysian sort. What Mr. Huxley calls the social emotion, the feeling of excitement caused by being in a crowd, far from being chief among Buddhist emotions, is deliberately excluded by it from their number. One of the signs by which the Dharma might be recognized, the Buddha told Mahapajapati, was that it conduced to solitude, not to company. The bliss arising in the concentrated mind of the disciple is said, according to one interpretation of the word, to be, quote, born of solitude, unquote. Quote, wander alone as the horn of the rhinoceros is single, unquote, sings the refrain of a poem in the Sutta Nipata, which celebrates the delights of and enumerates the spiritual advantages which accrue from a life of solitariness. Not excitement, but silence. The Aryan silence, wherein not words merely, but also the perturbations of the mind are stilled, is the emotion evoked by those assembled, either in the presence of the Buddha, or after the disappearance of his earthly body, to do honour to his memory. When the physician Jivaka took Ajatasattu, the Raja of Magadha, on a nocturnal visit to the master's abode, so deep a silence surrounded the place that the king became suspicious and accused the physician of leading him into an ambush. The story is told with all the dignity and quiet beauty of the Pali scriptures thus. Now when His Majesty Ajatasattu was close upon the mango grove, there came upon him fear and trembling, so that every hair upon his body stood on end, and he exclaimed to Jivaka, "Surely, Master Jivaka, you are deceiving me. Surely, Master Jivaka, you are playing a trick upon me. Are you not delivering me into the hands of mine enemies, Jivaka?" Being reassured by Jivaka, he went on, "How is it then that there is not a sneeze, not a clearing of the throat, not a single sound to be heard in all this company of brethren, numbering, as you say, 1,250? Fear not, Maharaja. Fear not, Maharaja. I am not deceiving your majesty, nor playing you a trick, nor am I delivering your majesty into the hands of your enemies. Go right on, Maharaja. Go right on, Maharaja. See, yonder in the pavilion the lamps are burning." Then the Raja went on, riding his elephant as far as the path allowed, then went on foot to the pavilion door. Then he said to Jivaka, "Where, Master Jivaka, is the Exalted One?" "Yonder, Maharaja, is the Exalted One. Yonder, Maharaja, is the Exalted One, sitting up against the midpost pillar, facing east and surrounded by the brethren." Then the Raja of Magadha, Ajatasattu, drew near to the Exalted One and stood aside. So standing, he gazed upon that company sitting there in perfect silence, calm as a translucent pool. And he exclaimed, "Oh, that my boy Prince Udayi, the lucky lad, may be blessed with the peacefulness wherewith this company of brethren is now blessed." The apprehensiveness of an ancient Indian despot who went in constant fear of betrayal and assassination is in this passage strikingly contrasted with the calm and untroubled bearing of the Buddha and his disciples, who, far from abandoning themselves to the feeling of excitement caused by being in a crowd, were enjoying tranquillity of mind so great that the king could imagine for his darling son no blessing more desirable. "Asceticism is common to all religions," says Mr. Huxley, of the third of his recognisedly religious states of mind and actions. Had he ended with these words, as well as begun with them, and permitted the reader to understand the word asceticism in whatever way he would, all had been well, and with one statement at least we should have had no cause for disagreement. Unfortunately, in the next sentence he makes it clear that by asceticism he means the belief that men could, quote, "win the favour of the gods by abstaining from pleasure and comfort," end quote. We have already shown that to the Buddha and his disciples the gods were not objects of fear, and from that for which no fear is felt, obviously no attempt will be made to win favours. Abstention from pleasure and comfort for the mere sake of abstinence, or with a wrong view that self-torture could lead to enlightenment, was one of the two kinds of extreme methods tried and rejected as useless by the Buddha, and was afterwards condemned by him as painful, unworthy, and unprofitable at the commencement of his first sermon at Sarnath. The world-honoured one taught instead a middle path, which consists, on the level of ethics, in an equally scrupulous eschewal of self-indulgence and self-mortification. Mental purity can be won neither by pleasure nor by pain, but only by that special kind of wisdom, third of the three ascending stages into which the noble eightfold path or middle way is divided, mention of which has already been made. Asceticism can be considered as an integral part of the Buddhist way of life, as a factor which contributes to the growth of wisdom, only if we use the word in its original Greco-Roman sense of that training or discipline which, as Jayavola says, aims at placing all the energies of the human being under the control of a central principle. This kind of asceticism is not confined to religion, but is one of the chief instruments whereby physical, intellectual, or artistic excellence of any kind is achieved. It is the blade which, pruning the exuberance of nature into the restraint of art, in the widest sense of that term, renders possible the unfolding of perfect blossoms of human culture. And Buddhism, it may be added, does not confuse the blade with the blossom. Asceticism is very definitely regarded only as a means to an end, and that this end has nothing to do with winning the favours of gods, we now hardly need insist. The next neatly cartoned product shot out by Mr. Huxley's selective machinery is labelled Future Compensatory States, or, in plainer language, Heavens and Hells. Belief in the existence of these states or places he lays before us as, quote, one of the most typical religious doctrines, unquote. And he accounts for its prevalence by saying, quote, human misery is so great and so widespread that one of the principal functions of religion has been that of consolation, unquote. This explanation, of course, suffices only for the heavens and not for the hells. Be that as it may, the fact that human beings suffer has never been denied by Buddhism, which indeed, on the contrary, directs its attention primarily to pain and the sensation of pain. However, though it teaches rebirth or re-becoming, punabhava, after death, either in this world or another, the process of compensation goes on in strict accordance with the law of moral equity, whereby selfish volitions result in suffering and unselfish ones in happiness. We are compensated not for what others have done to us, but for that which we have done to others. Our sufferings on this earth, far from being in need of future compensation, are themselves generally the retribution of our misguided volitions in previous existences. Buddhist teaching on the subject of compensatory states can hardly be described as consolatory. In fact, it can scarcely be described as essentially and specifically Buddhist. What may be termed the higher teaching of Buddhism points out that suffering is inseparable from sentient existence, and that true happiness is to be attained not by re-seeking rebirth in any heaven world, however glorious, but by eradicating that craving for continued individual existence which is the cause of rebirth, and by attaining, not after death but in this very life itself, the imperishable bliss of nirvana. Absoluteness is a quality typical of religious beliefs, says Mr. Huxley of the fifth item in his catalogue. Quote, religious doctrines are held with a passionate tenacity. If what is believed is absolutely true, then it is of vital importance that the believer should cling to his belief and refuse to admit the contrary beliefs of others. Conversely, absoluteness of belief, resulting from whatever cause, tends to create a certainty of the absolute reality of the thing believed in. The quality of the faith is transferred to its object, which thereby becomes absolute and consequently worthy of worship. End of quote. Nowhere else, perhaps, does Buddhism so clearly tower with supreme transcendence above all other religions than when it teaches not the absoluteness but the relativity of all religious beliefs and practices whatever, its own included. Of the supreme experience of nirvana, no attribute can be predicted, no quality affirmed. All that can be said is that certain beliefs and practices conduce to its achievement, while others do not. The former are collectively termed dharma, which is the correct word for what is popularly called Buddhism. The latter, adharma, or that which is contrary to dharma. Far from encouraging his disciples to hold his doctrines with a passionate tenacity, the Buddha time and time again reminded them that, in the words of the famous parable of the raft, the dharma was something to leave behind, not to take with you. One who thought that ethics, concentration, and wisdom were ends in themselves, and not simply a means for the attainment of nirvana, and who endowed them with absolute value, was in his opinion no less foolish than a man who, after crossing a great river, should bear away on his shoulders the raft whereon he had paddled over, instead of hauling it up onto the shore or sinking it in the water and going about his business. Since for the Buddhist none of his own beliefs is absolutely true, it is not of vital importance that he should cling to his belief and refuse to admit the contrary beliefs of others. Typical as this attitude is of the followers of other religions, it is quite unfamiliar to those who truly follow the Buddha. The Buddhist attitude is that of the sharp-sighted man in another parable, the parable of the elephant, who saw with a smile of amusement six blind men disputing about the nature of that lordly pachyderm, one seizing its trunk and declaring it to be like a serpent, another grasping its ear and maintaining that it resembled a winnowing basket, and so on, one after the other, until they all fell into a rage and began fighting among themselves. Views are, in Huxleyan language, rationalization of egocentric emotions, and enlightenment cannot be obtained until they are abandoned. Even right views, the intellectual formulation of the conditions precedent to the attainment of nirvana, are not to be understood as metaphysically true or clung to as though they possessed absolute validity, but simply to be used with discrimination for the attainment of those ends to which they are in the nature of things best adapted. Absoluteness of belief being absent from Buddhism, there is no question of it tending to create a certainty in the absolute reality of the thing believed in. The kind of faith and worship ensuing from this certainty are therefore meaningless words to it. Almost equally meaningless, from the Buddhist point of view, is the word priest, despite the fact that Mr. Huxley introduces the last item of his catalogue with the generalisation, quote, all religions have priests who fulfil a double function. They are, proceeds his description, in the first place to use Mr. Paul Valéry's expressive phrase, les propos aux choses vagues, meditators between man and the surrounding mystery, which they understand and can propitiate more effectually than ordinary folk. Their second function is earthly. They are confessors, advisers, casuists, spiritual doctors. At certain periods, they have also been rulers. Though priest is hardly a correct rendering of the Aryan word bhikshu, which originally meant a mendicant friar, the life of the bhikshu has two aspects which are, in a sense, analogous to the double function which, according to Mr. Huxley, priests fulfil. He, quote, meditates, or rather mediates, between man and the surrounding mystery, not by propitiating malevolent beings on man's behalf, but by revealing through his own actions the greatest of all mysteries, the mystery of holiness. The bhikshu mediates between the ideal and the real and enables mankind to see the highest spiritual truths in terms of ordinary human life. He does more than this. By his practical instructions, he enables people to know the mystery of holiness for themselves. He helps them make it a part of their own experience. In this twofold way, combining example and precept, he makes the mystery to them a mystery no longer, and irradiates the darkness of the unknown with the light of realization. It has been truly said that a complete account of Buddhism could be given by simply denying one after another the statements made about it by non-Buddhist writers. Similarly, we have allowed our own descriptions of the principal states of mind and actions recognized as religious to emerge into view by laying bare the shortcomings of Mr. Huxley's account of them. These shortcomings are all due to the fact that, in spite of his disparagement of formal definitions of religion, he had lurking at the back of his mind a definition which was not broad enough to include Buddhism. The exclusion is significant, though with the exploration of that significance we are not now concerned. We are concerned instead with the discovery of a definition of religion which will be of service to us in our task of making clear the nature of the religion of art. Such a definition will necessarily deal not with adventitious frills and trimmings, but with the barest essentials of the thing, and even those essentials it must present, not in incipient or half-developed shapes, but only in the perfection of their fully articulated forms. If it should be objected that our attempt to elicit a definition of religion from a consideration of Mr. Huxley's catalogue was in fact nothing but an exhibition of the differences, both partial and complete, by which Buddhism is separated from all other faiths, we shall reply that such a proceeding was unavoidable, because Buddhism is not merely a religion among religions, but a religion with a capital R in its classical and archetypal form, disentangled from all irrelevant additions, so that a complete unfolding of the characteristics of religion inevitably results in a description of what, historically speaking, is the Dharma of the Buddha. The truth of this statement may be made more evident by abstracting our observations from their Huxleyan context and presenting them as an independent description of recognisably religious states and actions, after which we shall allow the rotundities of description to crystallise into the straighter lines and acuter angles of one of those abstract definitions which Mr. Huxley affected so much to despise. Our own catalogue, then, is briefly as follows. The fundamental religious state of mind is a sense of absolute fearlessness. This feeling is the result of freedom from selfish attachments and desires, which is itself the consequence of having abandoned the misconception that one is essentially a separate, unchanging individual being. Interpretations of existence which have been elaborated from rationalizations of egocentric emotions, such as hope and fear, dissolve like mist, and the emancipated mind shines forth in its intrinsic purity, unclouded by even the shadow of a concept. The religious feeling finds its active, as opposed to its theoretical, expression in the practice of ethics, the development of the mind through concentration, and the intuitive realization of higher wisdom, all of which are necessary steps on the path leading to liberation from the ego idea, and consequently to those emotions of fearlessness which are, for the individual who feels them, a proof of the authenticity of his realization. These emotions are accompanied by others no less tranquilizing, and therefore no less genuinely spiritual. Chief among these is what may be called the solitary emotion, the feeling of bliss and peace caused by being alone. Asceticism is not an end in itself, but only a means of concentrating the total energies of the personality along a single line of development. Self-torture is not only of no use in the spiritual life, but is even positively harmful. Human suffering is the result of selfish desires, of craving, and can cease only when those desires cease. Rebirth in a heaven after death, as the result of living virtuously, is possible, but since such a state is not everlasting, being subject to the universal law of impermanence, it also is eventually a source of suffering. Permanent happiness, the happiness of nirvana, can be obtained in this life itself by the destruction of craving. Relativity is a quality typical of religious beliefs. Religious doctrines should be followed, but they should never be made a basis of attachment. If what is believed is only relatively true, then it is of vital importance that the believer should not cling to his belief and refuse to admit the contrary beliefs of others. Conversely, tentativeness of belief, resulting from whatever cause, tends to create a conviction of the merely relative and instrumental value of religious doctrines and practices. Faith is belief in the efficacy of the means employed after we have put them to the test in our own life and experience. It is confidence based on knowledge. Buddhism is the only religion which has bhikshus, who fulfill a double function. They are in the first place living embodiments of the Buddhist ideal, and in the second are the teachers of that ideal to the world in general, and the Buddhist community in particular, as well as the conservators of the entire great heritage of Buddhist culture, the whole body of which collectively and each part individually is intended as a means of orienting human life in the direction of its highest goal. Having now given our own description of the archetypally religious states of mind and actions, it will not be difficult for us to telescope them into a definition of religion. The central principle stands out among the multiplicity of its applications with unmistakable preeminence. Religion is essentially the experience of egolessness. The truly religious life is the life of egolessness, and genuinely religious beliefs and practices are those by which the realization of egolessness can be achieved. Like most definitions, this one that we have given of religion is abstract and contentless in the extreme, and although nobody perhaps would be inclined to deny its correctness, not one of them probably would find it of much practical use. Definition is the result of comparison, abstraction, and generalization, all of which are intellectual operations. Warm, living, concrete things are fed into one end of the intellectual machine and emerge at the other cold, dead concepts, with every drop of emotion squeezed out of them. These concepts reason may manipulate in a ghastly puppet dance of argument, spinning round her bloodless ballet of unearthly categories in a complicated choreography of syllogisms, but though the performance may convince the head, it is powerless to move the heart. The heart can be moved only by emotions, and only the heart can move man. Intellectual recognition of the fact that religion consists in a life of egolessness is not sufficient to inspire anyone actually to live such a life, because his emotional energies have not been involved. To know what is good is not the same as to do what is good, because, as Aristotle remarked in his unanswerable criticism of the ethical theory of Socrates, it fails to take into consideration the irrational parts of the soul. Every religion therefore attempts not only to justify its teachings to the intellect, but also to recommend them to the feelings. Through myth, ritual, literature, painting, sculpture, and music, each tries to canalize emotion into the arid fields of the doctrines in which they wish us to believe and the practices they desire us to follow. In this way arises what is generally known as religious art. But, as might be expected, an ambiguity lurks in the word religious, and in order not to be confused by it, we shall have to bear in mind the description of truly religious mental states and practices we have already given, and the definition of religion which we elicited from that description. Religious art is that kind of poetry, music, painting, or any other species of art which conduces to the experience of egolessness. Much conventionally religious art, particularly Christian art, is not religious art in the sense that we have defined the term, because it not only fails to induce the experience of egolessness, but even positively strengthens the ego sense. The kind of pseudo-religious art that we have in mind is represented by sensually attractive Madonnas, such as the Italian Renaissance painters so abundantly produced, and by literary works such as the Ramacharitamanasa of Tulsidas, which, despite its poetical beauties, is only the hot air of devotional frenzy, inflating the bladder of Brahminical egoism. The direct contrary of such pseudo-religious art, which is religious in subject but non-religious in sentiment, is what may be termed naturally or essentially religious art, which is religious in sentiment, though non-religious in subject. Examples of this kind might be multiplied indefinitely. Chinese landscape painting, the best of Shelley's poetry, and much of the music of Beethoven are sufficient to represent it. Two more permutations of the terms religious art and non-religious art it is possible to obtain. The first of these is religiously both conventional and natural, in subject as well as sentiment, while the second is religious in neither, a work of art of this type being merely a profane subject, profanely treated. The Buddha image is perhaps the finest example of the one, and almost all contemporary popular art among the worst examples of the other. Further refinements of classification it would be possible to introduce, but since they are irrelevant to our present purpose, we abstain from making them. Of the four categories of art already mentioned, our concern is with the second only, for it is this which supplies the raw material, as it were, of the religion of art. We are not concerned with artworks of the first category, because their ostensible religiosity often prevents them from appealing to modern sensibility, while their lack of truly religious sentiment, their failure to impart the experience of egolessness, renders them valueless from the point of view adopted in our present inquiry. With the fourth kind of art we have no concern, not only because it is not in any sense religious, but because it is perhaps only superficially art. The domain of the religion of art, as demarcated at the beginning of our inquiry, is that province of art which is also a province of religion, and that part of true religion which is also a part of art. But before attempting to deal with the religion of art, it will be necessary for us to deal separately with the nature of art, just as we had already to deal separately with the nature of religion. Art is essentially creative. Like the general creativity of human life, civilization and culture, of which it is the highest and most intensified development, it creates not out of nothing, but by impressing its own ideal forms upon the chaos of sensuous experience. The materia prima, the stuff and raw material that an artist subdues and adapts to his creative purpose, is compounded of outlines, colours, masses, words and sounds with which all men are familiar, and which are indeed themselves products of the rudimentary artistic activity, if not of humanity, at least of an important section of the human race. These sensuously given elements, the painter, sculptor, poet, and musician, organize into formal relations which, by some mysterious resonance of the human spirit, are capable of imparting a pleasure more intense and rare than that given by sensuous experiences which have not been so organized. But however intense the pleasure given by works of art, it would be a mistake to suppose that art gives nothing but pleasure. Poetry, for example, which is the most fully developed form of art, even as Buddhism is the archetypal form of religion, is not only pleasurable, but meaningful. Besides expressing the poet's emotions, it communicates his sense of values. It is the organ not merely of his feelings, much less still only of his thoughts, but of the whole unified sensibility with which he explores undiscovered regions of experience. Though the terms sensibility and experience have been allowed to stand for the subjective and objective aspects of artistic realization, it should not be thought that the rigid line of demarcation can be drawn between them. Experiences are not possessions like pieces of furniture, but states and modifications of our own being, or in more Buddhistic language, of our own becoming. The poet experiences things directly by assimilating them into his spiritual being in much the same way as he assimilates material food into his physical body. For this reason, some philosophers of art have thought that art was adequately defined as intuition, in which the subject and object of experience coalesce, as it were, into one. What the poet or any other artist tries through his special medium to express is not so much an unfamiliar kind of experience as a new mode of being. As Rilke says at the end of his sonnet, Archaic Torso of Apollo, "Here is no place that does not see you. You must change your life." The you to whom the poet addresses his exhortation is what Indian aesthetics has termed the rasika, a much better word than either the aesthete or critic of European artistic tradition. The taster or enjoyer of the rasa or aesthetic relish which saturates a work of art. For art is not only expression but communication as well. According to Herbert Reed, it communicates a sense of values. Values are things that are desirable not as a means to the attainment of other things, but for their own sakes. Modes of being or states of consciousness, in Buddhist philosophy being and consciousness are equated, which are expressed in and communicated by works of art, are not values from the point of view of the artist, for he has already attained them, but only to his audience, who are first of all startled into an enhanced awareness of life by the impact of a sensibility infinitely more refined and powerful than their own, and then confronted with the terrible necessity of renouncing their old self and transforming it into a new personality by the assimilation of a wholly unfamiliar experience. Often they shrink from what their natural egoism regards as the stress and pain of such transformation. They feel only the terror of death, and not the joy of birth into a richer and larger life. J.B. Leishman, compares the lines which we have just quoted from Rilke with the description in the poet's Malte Lauritz-Brigge of a certain actress, probably Eleonora Duse, who, quote, tried to distract the gaze of the audience from herself to the immense reality that filled her. But they were already breaking into applause in their terror of the extreme, as though at the last moment to deflect from themselves something that would compel them to change their lives. At this stage of our inquiry, which has now brought us to the point at which the realm of art begins to overlap the realm of religion, we may fittingly condense our findings into a formal definition of the nature of art, before attempting to gain admittance to the fascinating domain of the religion of art, or to continue our journey through its unexplored interior. Quote, art is the organization of sensuous impressions into pleasurable formal relations that express the artist's sensibility and communicate to his audience a sense of values that can transform their lives. I repeat, art is the organization of sensuous impressions into pleasurable formal relations that express the artist's sensibility and communicate to his audience a sense of values that can transform their lives. The completeness of this definition becomes clearly apparent when we compare it with fragmentary definitions according to which art is, quote, an attempt to create pleasing forms, unquote, that is from Herbert Reed, Clive Bell's significant form, or most simply of all, Croce's intuition. It moreover illuminates the significance of definitions of beauty as modern as Herbert Reed's beauty is the unity of formal relations among sense perceptions, or as ancient as the scholastic beauty is the splendour of form reflected on the proportioned parts of matter. Having now formed a clear, even if rather abstract, idea of the nature of religion and the nature of art as independent lines of human activity, we must now trace out the parallels between them, as well as determine, if possible, their exact points of intersection. First of all, we shall have to examine the relation between egolessness and art, but the examination will be fruitful only if we load every rift of our conception with the awe of concrete meaning. In spite of its negative form, the word egolessness, or in unmixed Anglo-Saxon, unselfishness, is far from devoid of positive content, as we shall presently see, though our effort to reveal that content may well begin with an explanation of the principle which it negates. This principle, strange to say, is in truth itself a negation, a suppression of reality. That is to say, it is a delusion. The ego does not really exist. It is not a thing, but a thought. Not a metaphysical entity, but an epistemological error. It is simply the idea of a separate individuality. Since ideas are themselves things, not in the sense of being material objects, but in the sense that they are capable of producing tangible effects, the idea of separate individuality does not remain ineffectually floating about in the ether of consciousness, but descends upon the earth in a storm of consequences. Being a wrong idea, it proliferates effects which are wrong. The first of these effects is the attraction and aggregation of material particles into a human body endowed with sense organs through which the enucleating ego will be able to gratify that craving for individual existence, that longing for experience as a separate self, which is as carried over unsatisfied from previous births, and which is the cause of its present reincarnation. In this new body, it experiences sensations that enhance its feeling of separateness, and sensations which diminish it and even threaten the existence of its physical basis. The former it describes as pleasurable, the latter as painful. These simple sensations of pleasure and pain are connected with the idea of external cause, and in this way the automatic responses of attraction and repulsion are transformed into conscious desire and aversion, together with all the elaborate variations and permutations of these two great feelings which constitute the self-centered emotional life of ordinary people. Since men live not in solitude, but in society, their efforts to maintain and augment their own separate selfhood inevitably bring them into conflict with all the millions of other men who are engaged in the same attempt. Interests differ, and therefore individualities necessarily clash. Different social groups come into conflict with one another. Religions disagree, and holy wars are preached. National existences are threatened, and armies march to the battlefield. Bodies of men, women, and children are hideously mutilated or blown to pieces. Blood flows like a river. The details of such scenes of human conflict are nowadays too familiar to require further particularization. As Spinoza long ago understood, individuals, nations, and all other things endeavor to persist in their own mode of being, or, as we should ourselves phrase it, to prolong their own stream of becoming, to go on repeating over and over again the same old pattern of experience. The colors may vary from time to time, the threads be changed from coarse to fine, but all are woven into the same unchanging pattern. If, to use a more dynamic metaphor, some new experience rushes comet-like from the unknown immensity of the surrounding universe, the ego steadies itself grimly on its axis and, putting forth all its powers of attraction, endeavours to draw the intruder from his path and swing him around like a planet at the circumference of its own little solar system. Selfishness is simply unwillingness to face new experiences. A radically new experience, which we cannot weave into the pattern of our life, demands the changing of the pattern and the working out of a fresh design in which it can form a part. The ego resists the onrush of new experiences because of the changes they involve. For a change in experience means a modification of existence. And though in relation to the new life such a modification is a birth, in relation to the old life, to the ego, it is in fact a death. Unselfishness, on the other hand, is an openness to new experiences, a willingness to die for the sake of being born anew. If egoism is a centripetal tendency, a movement of contraction upon its own centre, egolessness, on the contrary, is a centrifugal tendency, a movement of expansion not only towards its own circumference, for this has no meaning except in relation to a centre, but towards something absolutely outside the orbit of its own being. If a new experience appears comet-like in the sky, it eagerly abandons its own planetary system and spins towards it, singing with Shelley's moon, "I must hurry, whirl and follow, through the heavens, wide and hollow." This is the spirit of the true artist. Possessing from his birth an extraordinary sensitiveness to what Wordsworth called unknown modes of being, a capacity to experience what Mr. Aldous Huxley, writing of D.H. Lawrence, describes as the dark presence of the otherness that lies beyond the boundaries of man's conscious mind, he is passionately eager to widen and deepen the range of his experience to the farthest possible limit. Now, experience is of two kinds: that which relates to the external world of flowers, trees, people, mountains, and stars, and that which relates to the internal world of emotions, thoughts, imaginations, and intuitions. Our use of the words widen and deepen refers to the possibility of developing experience in these two directions. The artist widens his experience by continually increasing the number of his points of contact with the material universe in which he lives. For, like Antaeus in the myth, contact with the earth strengthens him. He deepens his experience, or heightens it, for both words connote refinement and intensification, first of all by becoming aware of it, and then by subjecting it to a process of prolonged incubatory reflection, in which essentials are separated from accidents, and the significance of the experience gradually disclosed. Contact with the earth is, of course, possible only through the body, by means of the five senses, particularly the eye, and to the poet's awareness through this highly sensitive organ, of what we have elsewhere described as the unique individuality of things. We have already given the name observation. When an object is observed intently for some time, sympathy for it will begin to be felt. For in the act of pure observation, self-awareness is suspended, and, at least for an instant, subject coalesces with object and feels the pulse of its existence beating indistinguishably from its own. Contact with unknown modes of being, on the other hand, is possible not through any external sense, but only through an internal organ of experience, by means of refined and subtilized emotion. As we have explained in our Advice to a Young Poet, emotion, which is a force, can be subtilized by what we have there called the asceticism of art, wherein conscious inhibition of the normal outlets of emotional energy succeeds in making it seek expression on higher and more refined levels of existence. Though we have spoken of the two kinds of experience, one having the external, the other the internal world for object, it should not be supposed that they exist side by side without any deeper or more intimate relation than that of mere external juxtaposition. They are not so much two worlds as two hemispheres of experience within the one world of the artist's personality. Between these two hemispheres, a continual traffic goes on. Facts are forever crossing over into our personal life as feelings, and experiences, which are both thoughts and feelings, as well as something more significant than either, go forth into the external world not as fugitive words and deeds, but as immortal works of art. The poet, to change the metaphor, is rooted in the objective world as a plant is rooted in the soil. The nutriment which he derives therefrom is transformed into the invisible sap of aesthetic experience and creative potency, re-emerging thence into visibility not as earth and water, but as the marvel of a leaf or the miracle of a flower. For the true poet seeks not only to enrich his experience through observation of and sympathy with life in all its multitudinous forms, but also to refine it, to raise it to the highest possible pitch of intensity, by solitary reflection on its meaning. Poetry which has not been enriched by the continual influx of sensuous impressions lacks vitality, while that which has not been refined by prolonged meditation is drossy and impure, and incapable of imparting to the rasika that sudden shock of delight which transports him into a hitherto unknown region of experience. The rhythm of the poet's life is dominated by the systole and diastole of receptiveness and creativity, absorption and transmutation, enrichment and refinement. Sometimes his heart expands until it embraces the universe. Sometimes it contracts into a point. Both movements are necessary, and the soul of the poet can no more exist with one only than his physical body can live with a heart that only pumps blood in or only pumps it out. The first kind of poetic experience, the necessity for that subtle alchemy whereby objective fact is transmuted not merely into subjective feeling, but into the very stuff of the poet's personal life, has found poignant utterance in Rilke's well-known description of poetry in the Notebook of Malt Lauridge Brigg. He writes, "But alas, one does not get very far with verses if one writes them too early. One should wait and collect sense and sweetness during a whole lifetime, and if possible a long one, and then, right at the end, one might perhaps be able to write 10 lines that were good. For verses are not, as people suppose, feelings. One has them soon enough. They are experiences. For the sake of a verse, one must see many cities, men and things. One must know animals. One must feel how birds fly and understand the gestures with which little flowers open in the morning. One must be able to look back upon roads in unknown regions, on unexpected meetings and on partings that one long foresaw, on days of childhood that are still unexplained, on parents whom one had to hurt, if they brought one a pleasure and one did not comprehend it, it was a pleasure for someone else. On childish illnesses that began so strangely, with so many difficult and deep changes, on days in still, subdued rooms, and on mornings by the sea, on all that the sea can mean, on seas, on nights of travel that rushed away on high and flew with all the stars, and even if one is able to think of all that, it is not yet sufficient. One must have memories of many nights of love, of which not one was like another, of cries of women in labour, and of light, white, sleeping women in childbed, who are closing. But one must also have been beside the dying, must have sat beside the dead in the room with the open window and the intermittent sounds. And still, even to have memories is not sufficient. If there are many of them, one must be able to forget them, and one must have the great patience to wait till they return. For the memories themselves are not yet what is required. Not till they become blood within us, look and gesture, nameless and no longer distinguishable from ourselves, not till then is it possible, in some very rare hour, for the first word of a verse to arise in their midst and to proceed from them. The second kind of experience, the indispensable complementary process in which the enriched poetic personality is elevated to hitherto unscaled heights of being by the deliberate refinement of its emotional energies, has been admirably described by J.P. Leishman in his commentary on Later Poems. He writes, "Here we have the very kernel of what might be called Rilke's philosophy of love. He felt that the immense reserve of emotional energy developed or released by that experience ought not to be squandered on a transient and comparatively trivial satisfaction, but suppressed, repressed, dammed up like a stream until it reached an almost unbearable intensity, and then used as a propulsive force for some journey to the infinite, to undiscovered regions of thought and feeling. It might perhaps be objected that here art was encroaching upon life, that while the exhortation to sublimate his emotional experiences, to divert and convert them into means of imaginative discovery and creation, may be valid for the artist, it is only partially valid for humanity in general. I feel there is something in this objection, but at the same time I also feel that, like many other objections to Rilke, it tends to flatter too much our satisfaction with ourselves as we are." Inasmuch as love is the basic emotion, even as desire is the fundamental feeling, love being, according to Spinoza, pleasure accompanied by the idea of an external cause, Rilke's philosophy of love is no less a philosophy of all the emotions, and his technique of sublimation can therefore be applied not to one emotion alone, but to the whole affective life. This process of sublimation is for the artist not only valid, but an indispensable part of his artistic experience. If it is only partially valid for humanity in general, the reason is that ordinary men and women are only partially artists. Their sensibilities are coarse, their imagination weak, and their creative power constantly frittered away on transient and comparatively trivial satisfaction. Whatever their nominal religion may be, such people more often regard their physical body as the centre of the universe, and the gratification of the senses, together with the occasional titillation of the lower mind, as the highest aim of existence. As yet, no spark of divine discontent has fallen from the stars to set their hearts ablaze. The winds of spirit search for them in vain from end to end of the sky. They sit snug all the while in the cosy cottage of individual selfhood, huddling over the smoky flame of desire, and are quite content to be shuttered in from the airs of truth that blow so clean and cold outside. Any interruption of the noiseless tenor of their way, to say nothing of any quickening of their dormant spiritual life, or any drastic modification of their own being, is farther from their thoughts than flying to the moon. They do not want to change their lives. They are, as Leishman phrases it, satisfied with themselves as they are. Most human beings are content to be human beings, just as a pig is content to be a pig, and long indeed is the coming of that spiritual dawn when, By vengeful working of mysterious codes, an angel wakens in the drowsy beast. That dawn can come either from religion or from art, in the sense that we have defined them, and one might as well blame light for encroaching on darkness as object to art that it encroaches upon life. It is the function of art to encroach upon life. For a great work of art embodies an unfamiliar experience, and this experience confronts us as the archaic torso of Apollo confronted Rilke with a challenge and demand, with the flat imperative, you must change your life. If in our terror we refuse to accept that challenge, to meet that demand, then the world of art is in reality closed to us. Then we either have not intercourse with it at all, or else attempt to enjoy works of art without permitting them to transform our lives. In the first case we become Philistines, in the second aesthetes of the type satirized in The Palace of Art. Tennyson's glorious devil, large in heart and brain, that did love beauty only, was simply a man who thought of art as a comparatively refined means of sensuous pleasure, as an elegant cupbearer at the feast of life, rather than as a bare skeleton grimly announcing the necessity of terrible transformations. Death and art are terrible for the same reason. Both represent change. Religion, we have already seen, is essentially a life of egolessness. And egolessness, as we have found, is fundamentally a willingness to accept new experiences. The religion of art may therefore be defined as conscious surrender to the beautiful, especially as manifested in poetry, music, and the visual arts, as a means of breaking up established egocentric patterns of behaviour and protracting one's experience along the line of egolessness into the starry depths of reality. It will be noted that we speak not merely of experiences, but of new experiences. For only a new experience is capable of making a breach in that thick wall of selfhood with which most of us are surrounded. By new, we do not mean, however, the relative newness of, for instance, a young man's first experience of love, which is new only to him, but of what is, within the limits of average human experience, the absolute newness of a symphony of Beethoven or a sonnet by Keats. According to some ancient Indian poets, the essential quality of beauty is that it remains from moment to moment ever new. Tadeva rupam ramanayataya kshane kshane yanavatam vidate. Since every new experience compels a fresh modification of character, it might be possible to describe beauty not only as that which is always new, but also as that which, far from allowing us the luxury of remaining satisfied with ourselves as we are, demands from moment to moment a fresh transformation of our lives. Absolute beauty, to plunge for a minute into the stormy sea of metaphysics, would then be that beauty whose demands upon us are inexhaustible, which never allows us to rest in any perfection, and which even beyond what seems to us the highest transformation calls for another higher still. This conception of the aesthetic life as being fulfilled in a perpetual progress, rather than in a definite arrival at a fixed point of achievement, is paralleled by an early Buddhist teaching, the significance of which was first emphasized by Dr. Beni Madhab Barua in his lecture on Buddhism as Personal Religion. According to this teaching, which though attributed to the nun Dharmadina was approved by Buddha himself, quote, Buddha's causal genesis admits of two different trends of things in the whole of reality. In one of them, the reaction, Patibhaga, takes place in a cyclical order between two opposites, pachanikas, such as pleasure and pain, sukha, dukkha, virtue and vice, punya, papa, good and evil, kusala, akusala. This is aptly termed by Buddhaghosa as visabhaga patibhagas. In the other, the reaction takes place in a progressive order between two counterparts or complements, or between things of the same genus, the succeeding factor augmenting the effect of the preceding one. This is what Buddhaghosa terms Sadisa Patibhaga. By the term world, as distinguished from nirvana, we are to understand the first trend in the causal genesis, where we revolve within the cycle of reaction between the opposites. Nirvana represents the other trend in the causal genesis, in which the course of reaction lies from strength to strength, good to further good, from that to still greater good, from pleasure to joy, from joy to gladness, from gladness to happiness, from happiness to bliss, from bliss to beatitude, from intuition or knowledge, vijja, to the feeling of emancipation, vimutti, from that to self-mastery, vasibhava, or self-consciousness as to the acquisition of the free state, and from that to the fullest enjoyment of the bliss of nirvana. In reply to the question as to what follows by way of reaction from nirvana, Dharmadina wisely said that nirvana was generally regarded as the final step of the process in order to avoid an infinite regress. For the sake of parayanta gahanam, in her own language. But she has not failed to indicate that even if there lie any further reaction, that also takes place in the line, and that whatever follows therefrom will also appertain to nirvana, and therefore will partake of its nature. Less than 500 years after Dharmadina, these ideas received their full development in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, wherein the principle of infinite regress is accepted, and wherein the Bodhisattva is time and again exhorted not to rest in any dharma, not to regard any attainment as ultimate, including the attainment of nirvana, and wherein he is in fact even required to abandon the idea of attainment altogether. The greatest mistake an aspirant to the life of egolessness could make would be to think of egolessness as though it was a kind of attainment. For it is not so much a state or an experience as an attitude to all states and experiences whatsoever. This attitude reveals itself as a readiness to renounce old experiences and to face and embrace new ones. Egolessness is thus not any state of existence, howsoever exalted, but essentially a condition of will. Neither the saint nor the artist in goodness nor the saint of the beautiful, should allow himself to become attached to his experiences, attainments, or realizations. For to rest in any particular experience of the good or of the beautiful would mean nothing less than the collapse of his spiritual or aesthetic career. Art adores that absolute beauty which, since it is ever new, demands of its votaries the perpetual transformation of their lives, offering as reward for the terror of incessant death the joy of repeated birth into a life infinitely enriched and refined beyond all that is comprehensible and embraceable here. It does not allow them to settle down in any perfection, for, as Lama Govinda has pointed out, perfection itself is not an absolute value or a fixed condition, and, quote, neither exists as an end at the top of a scale nor as an absolute or fixed measurement, but as an infinitesimal moment of harmony in movement, unquote. The true artist understands this relativity of perfection no less thoroughly than the true saint does. He beholds beauty rising and shining beyond beauty as the mountaineer sees range upon range of hills rising up one behind another, each one loftier and grander than that beneath it. The traveller's eye must come to rest somewhere in the end, either on the last and loftiest range as it stands silhouetted against the sky, or on the blue depths of haze, indistinguishable from the sky itself, into which the contours of ridge and peak melt and fade away. But the eye of the artist never comes to rest, for beauty is inexhaustible. She is the ever-attained, and yet remains the ever-unattainable, and therefore the artist's longing and desire for her, though perpetually satisfied, are perpetually unsatisfied, so that he presses eagerly on through keener satisfactions, diviner discontents, and intenser longings, until he realizes, if he had not realized it before, that the prize is in the race, and beauty in truth nothing but the rhythm of delight within his own experience. Such is the natural egolessness of true artists, of the genuine devotees of beauty, the sainted souls of art. But here, just as we touch the highest point of our inquiry, two or three difficulties might arise, or one or two objections could be voiced, which must be resolved and answered before we can pursue the religion of art round into the full circle of its conclusion. The first of these difficulties arises out of the apparent instability and irregularity which often distinguishes the lives of artists, poets, painters, and musicians, from the lives of non-artists. In the minds of most tax-paying, form-completing citizens, art and immorality are almost synonyms, and it is more or less tacitly assumed that moral laxity is prerequisite to artistic achievement. Though our contention that egolessness is a substance of art, no less than of religion, might be at least theoretically acceptable to such people, our assertion of its corollary, that the true artist, far from being immoral, is, in fact, a spiritual being, and the genuinely aesthetic life essentially a life of spirituality, would therefore probably appear in their eyes not only unacceptable, but even positively absurd. Shrill voices would at once be raised to remind us of Byron's philanderings, while indignant fingers would point out to us the direction of Reading Gaol. The misconception out of which these difficulties arise is twofold. In the first place, it should not have passed unnoticed that, in our foregoing remarks, we have been careful to speak not of the artist, not just of any practitioner of poetry or painting, music or sculpture, but always of the true artist. What we intended this distinguishing epithet to convey has already been made partially clear by our fourfold classification of art into the 1. Essentially as well as conventionally religious type, the 2. Essentially but not conventionally religious type, the 3. Conventionally but not essentially religious type, and the 4. Neither conventionally nor essentially religious type. As soon as it is realized that our subsequent definition of art as, quote, the organization of sensuous impressions into pleasurable formal relations that express the artist's sensibility and communicate to his audience a sense of values that can transform their lives, unquote, excludes the third and fourth types, which, as we had already hinted when discussing them, were not only not essentially religious, but even only superficially art, then our conception of the true artist, as distinguished from the false practitioner of the arts, is one who produces art of the first and second types, that is to say, art which, either with or without the aid of accepted and understood religious symbols, communicates an experience which compels us to change our lives. As Carlyle finally says in Heroes and Hero Worship, quote, poet and prophet differ greatly in our loose modern notions of them. In some old languages, again, the titles are synonymous. Vates means both prophet and poet, and indeed at all times, prophet and poet, well understood, have much kindred of meaning. Fundamentally, indeed, they are still the same, in this most important respect especially, that they have penetrated both of them into the sacred mystery of the universe, what Goethe calls the open secret. What is here said of the poet is essentially true of the painter and musician, for Carlyle is really not concerned to point out the historical connection between the poetic and prophetic functions so much as to vindicate the existence of a common spiritual element, wherein both art and religion live and move and have their being. We believe that one who inhabits, as the true artist does, this spiritual element, who leads a life of egolessness by means of continual surrender to the incessant demands of the beautiful, is hardly more liable to instabilities and irregularities of conduct than is that other swimmer in spiritual deep waters, the genuine saint, who leads a life of egolessness by unfailing surrender to the demands of the good. This is not to say that the true artist may not sometimes behave egotistically, but this is due to the fact that he is an artist, yes, but that he is also a man. and constitutes a lapse from art no less than a fall from spirituality. We believe that to the extent that he is faithful to art, he will be not only a sure artist than ordinary people, but also much better as a man. That the lives of those who are not true artists, who produce art of the third and fourth types, should, on the contrary, frequently be disfigured by intemperance or passional excess, is only what might have been expected, since it is but natural that the same lack of egolessness manifested by their art should also be exhibited in their lives. Moreover, just as in certain shamanist rites of a psychic rather than of a spiritual order, a state of trance can be induced in the celebrant by means of intoxicants, so in art which is not essentially religious, which stands in the same relation to true art as shamanism does to true spirituality, a mood of seeming inspiration or emotional excitation can sometimes be induced by the abnormal stimulation of inordinate sensuous indulgence. The difficulty of recognizing that the truly aesthetic life is also a life of spirituality arises in the second place out of a misconception of the nature of ethics. Those unbending moralists to whom art and immorality are practically synonymous are generally found adhering to an external and legalistic conception of morals. To them, the moral life consists in the undeviating observance of an eternal and immutable moral code, and this moral code is regarded not as a means to some sublimer spiritual end, but as being an end in itself. By its imperatives, all human conduct is to be governed and judged. Those who conform to them are moral, the salt of the earth, the elect of God, while those who cannot or will not conform are immoral, accursed, and forever reprobate. We have no intention of questioning the utility of such prescribed patterns of behaviour. Neither society nor civilization could exist without them, and in the earlier stages of the spiritual life of the individual devotee, they are indispensable. All we wish to point out is this, that however useful for practical purposes a moral code may be, the criterion of ethics is, nevertheless, fundamentally not external, but internal. Although, generally speaking, a conventionally immoral action is at the same time an egoistic action, and therefore not only immoral, but unspiritual as well, exceptional cases do occur, which are conventionally immoral, but in truth both egoless and spiritual. Sometimes it happens that a man may be compelled to shatter moralities out of the sheer intensity of his spiritual life. This is not antinomianism, for, as D.H. Lawrence has finely said, quote, "the true artist does not substitute immorality for morality. On the contrary, he always substitutes a finer morality for a grosser." Unquote. The grosser immorality of which Lawrence speaks corresponds with the moral codes to which we have referred, and his finer morality to our life of egolessness and spirituality. Many spiritual masters appeared immoral in the eyes of their contemporaries because they had outgrown current notions of right and wrong. Socrates was sentenced to death for corrupting the youth of Athens. Jesus was rebuked by the Pharisees for allowing his disciples to pluck ears of corn, which technically was working, on the Sabbath, and for setting them the example of eating with unwashed hands. The Buddha scandalized the orthodox Brahmins of his day by disparaging the purifying power of ceremonial bathing and by bluntly denying the value of animal sacrifices, both of which practices were then considered as being of the very essence of religion. All three masters were not behaving immorally, but simply substituting a finer morality for a grosser one. Even while promulgating moral codes, both Jesus and the Buddha were careful to emphasize that such sets of rules possessed at the most a purely instrumental value. Love of God and one's neighbor was the ultimate value for Jesus, to the Buddha, the realization of nirvana. We may therefore conclude that the widespread impression that art and immorality are practically synonymous terms has been produced by a combination of three causes. Firstly, by a general failure to discriminate the true artist from the false. Secondly, by the fact that unlike the religious ascesis of the Buddhist devotee, the aesthetic ascesis of even the truest artist is rarely a conscious process, so that a fall from egolessness and the consequent performance of an immoral action is more to be expected of him than of his fellow pilgrim on the parallel path of goodness. And thirdly, by the fact that true artists, like genuine spiritual masters, do quite often substitute a finer morality of their own for the grosser moralities of the crowd. But in any case, there is no connection whatsoever between art and immorality. All true art, in both essence and effect, is egoless. The remaining difficulty relates to the value of the religion of art, not for the artist, but to one who is simply a lover of works of art, whether in the form of poems or paintings, pottery or architecture, musical compositions or sculptures. Such people may possess a deep and genuine love of beauty, and may be keenly sensitive, if not to all, at least to some of its numerous manifestations. But the necessity of earning a livelihood, the cramping pressure of daily routine, and above all, the exhausting strains and tensions of modern life, usually combine to prevent them from responding to the perceived beauty as actively and as ardently as they desire. Those to whom it is given to be saints of art will always be in minority. Even as among those who are called by religion, few will be chosen as artists in the spiritual life. The major portion of any given human community is doomed by limitations of character, no less than by restrictions imposed through external circumstances, to stand not in the inner sanctuary of egolessness, but in its outer courts. As one might have expected, the predicament of the average art lover runs almost exactly parallel to that of the ordinary religious-minded person. In the case of those who possess both artistic and religious interests, the parallelism is of course between twin aspects of their own personality. For whether one enters the temple of egolessness by the gate which is called beautiful, or through the portals of the good, or whether one enters in by both simultaneously, the difficulty of how the average worshipper, with the dust of the world's roads still white upon his feet, can be enabled to participate, at least for a few moments, in the mysteries of the inner shrine, remains the same. The first step to be taken towards the resolution of this difficulty is to understand that between saint and sinner, artist and critic, creator and enjoyer, expert and amateur, there is a difference not of kind, but only of degree. Just as there may be even in the true artist an element of egoism, which sometimes makes him act like an ordinary mortal, so there is in the average man an element of egolessness which enables him upon occasions to experience beauty as it is experienced by the true artist. With regard to their participation in egolessness through the mediation of the beautiful, the most devoted artist and the most casual enjoyer of works of art stand upon higher and lower rungs of the same golden ladder. With regard to the mode of their participation, however, there exists not a simple difference of degree, but, at least from the point of view adopted at this stage of our inquiry, the far more radical difference of kind. The artist's participation in the religion of art is a predominantly active participation. He explores realms of experience before unknown and reveals beauties hitherto unseen. The art lover's participation, on the other hand, is passive rather than active. Not that active creation necessarily excludes passive enjoyment. All that we wish to point out is that whereas in the artist's life active participation in the religion of art by means of aesthetic creativity occupies a position of greater centrality than passive participation through mere enjoyment of works of art, in the experience of the art lover, the relative positions of these two modes of participation are reversed, and enjoyment predominates over creation. Once more, an analogy between art and religion discloses itself. The relationship between the creator and the enjoyer of a poem or statue is paralleled by that between the master who gives and a disciple who receives a religious teaching. Quote, "The Tathagata, brethren, who, being Arahant, is fully enlightened, he it is who doth cause a way to arise which had not risen before, who doth bring about a way not brought about before, who doth proclaim a way not proclaimed before? Who is the knower of a way, who understandeth a way, who is skilled in a way? And now, brethren, his disciples are wayfarers who follow after him. That, brethren, is the distinction, the specific feature which distinguishes the Tathagata, who, being Arahant, is fully enlightened, from the brother who is freed by insight. In these words does the Buddha contrast his own creative role in the drama of Buddhism with the comparatively passive part played by his followers. Since the ordinary person participates in the religion of art more as a disciple than as a master, passively rather than actively, we shall deal with his enjoyment of the beauty of works of art first, and only afterwards with his own creation of beauty through personal aesthetic activity. Beyond the very limited point to which merely untrained and instinctive appreciation of the fine arts suffices to carry him, the value of the religion of art to the average man depends upon the clarity with which he understands the distinction between false art, which pervades the stale taste of ordinary egoistic human desire, and true art that caters to our deepest spiritual needs, the rich and substantial diet, the unique savour, the unsurpassed relish of emotions which, as they are without precedent in our experience, are an initiation into the mysteries of egolessness. This distinction between what may be provisionally termed good and bad art has to be made not so much for its theoretical value as for its practical consequences. Just as in the religious life, which parallels the life of art, the distinction between ethically good and bad actions is drawn less for the satisfaction of the philosopher than for the guidance of the devotee. He who becomes a devotee of the religion of art is required to discriminate works of false art from works of art which are genuine, not merely that he may understand, but that he may eschew them. Just as the thief must stop stealing before he can become an honest man, and as it is necessary for the debauchee to abandon his impure line of conduct before he can become chaste, so is the renunciation of the enjoyment of bad art an indispensable prerequisite to the full enjoyment of good art. Egoism and egolessness are contradictory attitudes, and poems or pictures ensouling them cannot but inspire in the hearts of their enjoyers emotions no less mutually contradictory than they are. Throughout the whole vast range of nature, we see exemplified the law that when the great gods come, the lesser gods depart. Unless the bud bursts, the flower cannot unfold its petals. And unless the flower withers and dies in its turn, no fruit can ever swell and ripen on the bough. In human life, too, childhood and adolescence, with all their charm, must pass away before maturity can be attained. Humanity must transcend itself in order to achieve superhumanity. Prince Siddhartha must die that a Buddha may be born. The religion of art's insistence that all pseudo-artistic rubbish must be swept from the highways of the soul before the car of beauty can drive in triumph, there is an application within its own domain of the same immutable law. What practical difference does this prohibition make in the aesthetic life of the art lover? If he accepts the authority of the religion of art, it will compel him to protect himself from bad art as carefully as he would take precautions against being infected by a particularly dangerous and virulent disease. He will have to stop reading almost all newspapers, which are generally bad literature in a state of putrefaction, pulp magazines, and that vast mass of tenth-rate fiction which the printing presses of the world turn out in such abundance. From second- and third-rate poetry, even, he should rigorously abstain. For although the quantity of first-rate poetry which has been written since the world began is small compared with that of other forms of literature, it is more than big enough to supply the utmost demands that may be made upon it by any single person. Cheap religious lithographs, shoddy reproductions of popular paintings, and badly printed commercial calendars in all their gaudy hideousness should be ruthlessly banished from the walls of his home. In artistic furniture, carpets, curtains and crockery should be dealt with in the same kind of way and replaced, if not by things which are genuinely beautiful, at least by articles which are well made, functionally appropriate, simple, and not so much an offence to the eye as such articles usually are. The devotee of the religion of art should be as much ashamed of being found with a sensational tabloid newspaper in his hand, a pair of unsightly factory-produced vases on his mantelshelf, or with two or three volumes of cheap fiction in his bookcase, as he would be if he was caught picking someone's pocket. Turning from the contents of the home to the home itself, such a devotee should do his best to ensure that his house is as beautiful outside, in materials, structure and setting, as it is inside. In this matter, the Indian peasant who lives in a thatched hut with grey mud-plastered walls, cow-dunged courtyard and threshold ornamented with intricate designs in rice paste, amid groves of plantain and mango, and with, perhaps, a pool or a tank nearby wherein to grow blue, red or white lotuses, is more fortunate than the well-to-do city dweller who lives in a house like thousands of other houses, in a street like thousands of other streets, with the smell of factory smoke in his nostrils and the noise of traffic thundering in his ears, with a balcony, if he is lucky, or a grubby backyard instead of a garden, a compartment in a brick box instead of a home, and more likely than not, a bundle of nerves instead of a soul. In the countryside, it is easy for a poor man to live beautifully, but in a city, it is difficult even for a very wealthy person to do so. Things cannot escape from each other. Beauty and ugliness are both contagious. Both spread and influence their surroundings. It is difficult for the city-dwelling art lover to beautify his own house without beautifying the houses of his neighbours also, for their ugliness casts, as it were, a dark shadow over the beauty of his own abode. Similarly, ugly houses cannot be eschewed without rebelling against an ugly street, and a rebellion against an ugly street cannot succeed in a town given over to ugliness. It would seem as though the efforts made by the devotee of the religion of art to eschew bad works of art cannot be wholly successful without the cooperation of the entire community. Aristotle has said that the function of the state is to provide the conditions upon which the good life depends. It is no less the function of the state to assist its citizens to lead an aesthetic life. Offences against beauty are no less reprehensible than offences against morals, and hence no less deserving of punishment. A businessman who inflicts a hideous factory upon the skyline is as much a menace to society as an embezzler of public funds, and the architect who designed it, the contractor who built it, and the workman who mixed the cement and swung the girders into position should be treated as his accomplices in crime. In a truly cultured community, the unsightly buildings which disfigure most of our modern cities would not be tolerated for a day. Unfortunately, such communities have become rare almost to the point of extinction, and in the anguish of his soul, the modern art lover often thinks wistfully of the lovely cities of ancient Greece, especially of Athens, city of the violet crown, with the Acropolis gleaming white upon her brow, and wonders whether beauty will ever reign upon the earth, as she reigned in those days over Hellas. Perhaps she will, if the religion of art succeeds in attracting a large enough following. Meanwhile, the art lover, despite his inability to pull down ugly houses or replan unsightly streets, can at least eschew within the walls of his own dwelling false painting, literature, and music in at least some of their innumerable contemporary forms. Without taking this preliminary step, without cleansing his heart of the egoistically toned emotions which false art induces, deep and genuine appreciation of true art, together with all that such appreciation means for his spiritual life, will be impossible. Before elucidating the significance of this appreciation, which will enable us to understand the value of the religion of art for the average devotee, we should briefly notice another form which, in modern civilization, the eschewal of ugliness often quite spontaneously takes. those periodical exoduses from town to country, which seem to have become almost an institution in many Western lands. Even admitting that people who spend weekends in the country or at the seaside are looking for health, amusement, or merely a change of scene as much as they are in search of natural beauty, still it cannot be denied that an unconscious urge to escape from the drabness and squalor of their everyday surroundings and to gaze upon the face of a beauty untouched by man impels them no less strongly than other motives. Unfortunately, as Aldous Huxley says in one of his earlier essays, beauty spots accessible to whole populations cease to be beauty spots and become black pools. Regrettably true as this statement is, we are now concerned not so much with appreciation of the beauty of nature as one aspect of a modern social phenomenon, as with the place of that appreciation in the life of the average devotee of the religion of art. Kant points out the close connection between the aesthetic and religious aspects of existence, thereby indicating their common fundamental spirituality, when he says, "An interest in the beauty of nature for its own sake is always a sign of goodness." From our present standpoint, the qualification "for its own sake" is important, since spirituality, or what the moralistically inclined Kant calls goodness, is, as we have seen, essentially an egoless attitude to life. There follows the consequence that only a selfless, that is to say, a disinterested, appreciation of the beauties of nature is capable of expressing aesthetically the selflessness of the truly ethical character. In a passage on the love of flowers, D.H. Lawrence discriminates with remarkable insight between the interested and the disinterested appreciation of natural beauty. He writes, "Now the love of flowers is a very misleading thing. Most women love flowers as possessions and as trimmings. They can't look at a flower and wonder a moment and pass on. If they see a flower that arrests their attention, they must at once pick it, pluck it. Possession! A possession! Something added on to me! And most of the so-called love of flowers today is merely this reaching out of possession and egoism. Something I've got, something that embellishes me. Yet I've seen many a collier standing in his back garden looking down at a flower with that odd, remote sort of contemplation, which shows a real awareness of the presence of beauty. It would not even be admiration or joy or delight or any of these things which so often have a root in the possessive instinct. It would be a sort of contemplation which shows the incipient artist." A sort of contemplation, yes, and how unmistakably does Lawrence indicate the connection between religion and art here, between the aesthetic and the ethical expressions of spirituality, when he makes this disinterested contemplation of a flower's beauty the sign of dawning artistic sensibility. Paradoxically, the value of natural beauty to the devotee of the religion of art is in inverse ratio to his merely egoistic consciousness that it has any value for him at all. The value of an inaccessible mountain peak or of a serenely floating cloud consists in its very valuelessness. It has no relevance to our material needs. We cannot turn the snow-clad peak into a human habitation, neither can we harness the white cloud to any earthly chariot. Nature is most beautiful when most aloof. Perhaps it is because of their sheer irrelevance to the needs of man, their utter indifference to his petty hopes and fears, that upon the face of gigantic mountain ranges, with their dreadful sunlit peaks and terrifyingly precipitous plunges into gloomy gorges, plays the intense and terrible light of a beauty never seen in fields or orchards, or in any other aspects of nature which have been brought into relation with the necessities of human life. Not that fields and orchards are unbeautiful. Formally speaking, they may be no less significant aesthetically than wilder and sterner scenes. But what the tabloid newspapers call human interest generally obtrudes itself, like the moon between the earth and the sun in a solar eclipse, so that we see not the brightness of their beauty, but only the dark shadow of their utility. For the same reason that he eschews bad art, the art lover would therefore be well advised, at least during the early years of his apprenticeship, to avoid the more domestic kind of natural beauty, and to cultivate instead appreciation for those aspects of nature which, since they have no connection with ordinary human interests, are most capable of liberating him from the bondage of selfish desires. Egoism is natural to man, and to be overcome only with the utmost difficulty. Only too readily do we stop to pluck the flowers of the world's beauty, instead of wandering and passing on. A mountain or a starry sky offers no foothold to our desires. We are left, as it were, naked in the midst of a great empty space full of sweeping winds. Consequently, our enjoyment of their beauty is of the truly aesthetic order, and a faint anticipation of that intenser enjoyment to be offered us by the still brighter beauty of works of true art. As we have already said, the artist's enjoyment of beauty is more intense and active, while that of the rasika is less intense and comparatively passive. The artist is masculine and plays the lover's role. The rasika is feminine and assumes the part of the beloved. These differences will have to be borne in mind when assessing the value of the religion of art for the ordinary person, though, as we shall presently see in greater detail, they indicate not so much the presence of contradictory qualities as the predominance of one quality over another in a single individuality. Such differences apart, however, the value of the religion of art, for those who wait in its outer courts, no less than for those who stand in the inner sanctuary, more than anything else consists in the broadening of their sympathies, in the enrichment and refinement of their experience, and in the uplifting of their transformed personality to new heights of being. Says Herbert Reed, "It has always been the function of art to stretch the mind some distance beyond the limits of the understanding. That distance beyond may be spiritual or transcendental, or perhaps merely fantastical. Somewhere it will overstep the limits of the rational." The distinction Reed makes here, rather diffidently it seems, between the spiritual or transcendental and the merely fantastical aspects of the distance beyond is, from the special viewpoint of the religion of art, without significance. If the fantastical does succeed in stretching the mind some distance beyond the limits of understanding, then the fantastical also is truly spiritual. For the presence of spirituality is revealed not by any outward sign, but simply by that readiness to accept new experiences, that willingness to modify the pattern of one's existence, which is implied whenever we speak of transcending the limits of our understanding. To us, the most interesting and significant part of the passage quoted is the concrete and expressive term used to describe the relation of art to the mind. Art stretches the mind. How difficult it would be to find a more appropriate verb. It connotes a continuity and at the same time a progressive development of experience through higher and higher levels of subtilization, not suggested by cruder and more abstract terms such as transcend, or even by concrete ones like overstep and pass beyond, all of which imply that the mind is somehow lifted up bodily over the limits of the rational, like some small boy over a fence and dumped down safely on the other side. The rational is not external to the mind, but the mind itself at one stage of its development. And to transcend the rational does not mean to transfer the mind unchanged from the rational to the super-rational plane — such transferals are possible only for physical bodies — but to continue changing it until a complete transformation takes place and it enters the super-rational stage of its development by becoming itself super-rational. Time and again, the literalness and abstractness of philosophic and religious terminology introduce confusions which vitiate the spiritual strivings of humanity. Most of these confusions, like that from which Herbert Reed saves himself by speaking of stretching the mind, arise from the misconception that the mind, or soul, or whatever else it may be called, is not a flux, a process, a santana, as the expressive Pali word has it, in a state of continuous change and development, but an inert, unchanging thing, subject only to external changes of time and place, and therefore differing from a stone in no observable particular. From this fatal misconception, which is in fact the rationalization of ordinary human egoism, the religion of art, no less than other forms of spiritual culture, promises to deliver us. If within the sphere of art itself the delusion that the mind is an immutable, non-material substance arises, the possibility of transforming the mind through art is precluded, and works of art are regarded not as engines of delight, but solely as instruments of selfish pleasure, with the consequence that the pseudo-aesthetic life depicted by Tennyson in The Palace of Art, together with the ruin which inevitably overtakes such a life, of necessity ensues in place of the train of lofty consequences set in motion by the religion of art. We should do well, therefore, to think of the function of art as being quite literally to stretch the mind. The implied comparison with a piece of elastic is far less objectionable than a covert comparison with a stone, stretching it further than the limits of its own rationality into the distance beyond of beauty, as this will enable us to see more clearly in what consists the value of the religion of art to its average devotee. Works of art are valuable to him because they stretch his mind. Usually his mind is stiff and unyieldingly rigid. Changes take place in it, but there is no development. The egoistic pattern of his life remains the same, though the elements composing it may vary from time to time. To a tough mind like this, conventional religion nowadays often appeals in vain. Tug and pull as she may, it stubbornly refuses to be stretched, or, even if she does succeed in stretching it for just a fraction of an inch, the minute her grip is relaxed, it flies back to its former position more obstinately than ever. Then along comes the artist. Gently, very gently, he takes hold of the reluctant mind. Slowly, oh so slowly, he starts drawing it out of itself, caressing and coaxing it all the time. Then, little by little, with infinite patience and inexorable firmness, he stretches and stretches it until it passes, no longer coarse and thick, but delicate as the thread of a spider's web, over the limits of selfhood into that realm of selflessness which is the homeland of true art, no less than of true religion. At first the mind shrinks from the artist's touch, but it soon discovers that to be stretched is, after all, not such an unpleasant experience as it is supposed. Eventually, the experience becomes a positive delight, dearer perhaps and more rewarding than any hitherto known. The spiritual life claims another devotee. So irresistible are the charms of art. As Irwin Edmund has written, "Values translated into immediately loved images have a powerful suasion on the imagination." Unquote. A single smile of beauty can bring about greater transformations of character than all the frowns of righteousness. Shelley gives fuller expression to the same idea when, in a famous passage of A Defence of Poetry, he declares, "The great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature, and an identification of ourselves with the beautiful which exists in thought, action, or person not our own. A man, to be greatly good, must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another and of many others. The pains and pleasures of his species must become his own. The great instrument of moral good is the imagination, and poetry administers to the effect by acting upon the cause. Poetry enlarges the circumference of the imagination by replenishing it with thoughts of ever new delight, which have the power of attracting and assimilating to their own nature all other thoughts, and which form new intervals and interstices, whose void for ever craves fresh food. Poetry strengthens the faculty which is the organ of the moral nature of man, in the same manner as exercise strengthens a limb." What Shelley describes as a strengthening of the mind corresponds to what Herbert Read speaks of as its stretching. Despite similarities or dissimilarities, for illustrations do not agree in all particulars with their object, much less still with each other, both figures bring out an important fact. Just as a limb is strengthened, not merely during the period of exercise, but for the time when the exercise is no longer being performed, so the mind, even after being stretched by art beyond the limits of the rational, does not relapse into quite the same degree of rigidity as it was habituated to formerly. In plain language, the impression produced by looking at a painting, listening to a symphony, or reading a poem does not disappear when we cease to look at the picture, or when the symphony ends, or when we put the poem by, or even when the memory of the delight they gave us has vanished. But it remains a permanent part of our character, modifying in however slight a degree the whole course of our life and conduct. Since the experience of art, like the experience of religion, is essentially an experience of egolessness, the impression produced on the soul by the enjoyment of works of art will be of the same nature. The man who bears on his soul, as it were, the stamp of egolessness, whether derived from religion through the will or from art by means of the imagination, will tend to act egolessly in all the relations of life. Such a one will be a good man in the noblest sense of the term, sensitive to the sufferings of others, sharing their sorrows and their joys, ready to help in time of need, not moved by greed or hate or fear, and ever seeking to share with his fellow men the joy of the beauty which he has known. In this way, as Erwin Edmund says, "Aesthetic enjoyment and artistic creation are anticipations of what the good life would really be. Such happiness as is present among our contemporaries is the happiness of those who are doing work that is itself delightful to them, and enjoying things that are themselves a delight." Unquote. The value to the ordinary man of participation in the religion of art through the enjoyment of beautiful things can be questioned only when the value of goodness and the value of happiness are questioned too. The second way in which the average man participates in the religion of art is through his own creative activities. Here the difference between the saint and the devotee of beauty is simply a matter of degree. All men have emotions. In fact, of such importance is the affective side of human life that it might be more truthfully said that men are what their emotions are. Since emotion has a natural tendency towards self-expression, towards the creation on the physical, aesthetic or spiritual level of an object in either its own likeness or in the likeness of the thing, person or event by which it was aroused, all men have a natural tendency towards the expression of emotion through creative activity. This expression may take two forms, one being achieved vicariously, for we are all poets when we read a poem well, through the contemplation, the other personally through the actual creation of works of art. Herbert Read clearly indicates the cathartic function of art when he writes, "The work of art is in some sense a liberation of the personality. Normally our feelings are inhibited and repressed. We contemplate a work of art and immediately there is a release. And not only a release, sympathy is a release of feelings, but also a heightening, a tautening, a sublimation." While not denying that this vertical release of feeling, as distinct from the horizontal release of mere sentimentality, can be affected by aesthetic contemplation as well as by aesthetic creation, we believe that the release affected through personal creativity is generally more satisfactory and complete than any other. Probably most artists, poets, and musicians would agree with us. The average man, with whose needs we are now concerned, often discovers that his own artistic achievements, however clumsy and inept they may be, give him a strange feeling of satisfaction, a peculiar thrill of delight, such as he was never able to derive from the greatest works of art. Even a mud pie, if he has made it with his own hands, may give a child more genuine pleasure than a costly painted toy. We therefore believe that in much the same way as, for the religious devotee, vicarious attainment of sainthood by reading the lives of saints cannot make up for his own actual shortcomings, so even the widest and richest enjoyment of works of art will not be able to compensate the art lover for the poverty of his own creative life. Not that it is possible for any man to be absolutely uncreative, for then he would be totally lacking in emotive energy, and such a being would be an even greater freak than a man without a head. Our creative instinct is in fact generally more alive than we realize, and every day manifests itself in 100 different ways. Dressing and adorning the body, furnishing a room, arranging books systematically on a shelf, or flowers in a bowl, planning a garden, laying the table for a meal, writing a letter, sewing a dress, embroidering a cushion, knitting a pullover, painting the woodwork of the house, making a kennel for the dog, icing a cake. All these activities and countless others provide us with outlets for our creative energies. The more consciously and deliberately we make use of them, the greater will be the satisfaction they give us. Nevertheless, they have their limitations. An ardent lover of beauty will not be content with touching the fringe of her robe, but will want to lift up his eyes and behold her face. Such a person will feel surging within him energies too impetuous and vast to be confined within the narrow channels of the domestic creativity just described. He will long for a more quiveringly intense experience, a more purely ardent enjoyment, for that quintessential, keen, ethereal bliss, which, within the limits of the religion of art, only the actual creation of a work of art can give him. At first, his heightened creative activity may take the form not only of combating ugliness in his surroundings, a subject which has been dealt with as preliminary to the enjoyment of works of art, but of trying to render them positively more beautiful. Sooner or later, however, he will feel compelled to start writing stories or poems, or to learn how to play a musical instrument, or how to paint or carve. Once he has reached this point and begins creating works of art, however inferior or valueless they may seem in comparison with the productions of artistic genius, as well as enjoying them, he becomes a fully-fledged devotee of the religion of art, and worthy to stand not merely in the outer courts of the temple of beauty, but within the inner precincts and the secret shrine. With the various kinds of creative activity, from poetry to pottery, or with the means whereby the skills necessary for the production of a work of art may be acquired, we shall make no attempt to deal. Information on these subjects is within the reach of those who really want it. Having briefly indicated the value of the religion of art to the average man, and having suggested ways in which he can deepen his participation in it through the enjoyment and creation of works of art, all that now remains to be done is to round off our remarks on the value of creative activities with two observations more, and then to conclude our inquiry into the religion of art with a few general reflections. Enjoyment of an object is often enhanced by a sense of obstacles surmounted and difficulties overcome. In art, the difficulties and obstacles by which the artist is confronted are generally technical. They arise out of the intractability of his material, whether it be words, sounds, or pigments, out of the resistance it offers to the fiat of his creative will. The artist has to wrestle with his medium as Jacob with the angel, but in the end it blesses him. One who knows naught of the struggle will not savour to the full the unction of that final benediction. This is the position of the man in the art gallery, or in the library, or any other repository of finished works of art. He enjoys them mildly, like a cow in a field munching a daisy, for he knows nothing of the sweat which dropped from the giant thews of genius producing them. He knows nothing of the anguish of struggling with that which, while it is the greatest obstacle to the artist's achievement, is also the indispensable condition of his success. He knows nothing of the triumph of technique. The man in the studio, on the other hand, The man who has at least tried to paint a picture or write a poem knows from experience how difficult the task is, knows from his own bitter pains the problems of composition, the inexorable requirements of metre and rhyme. When he looks at a picture or reads a poem, he will not only thrill with delight at beauties achieved, but rejoice at difficulties overcome. His enjoyment will be heightened and intensified to a degree that one ignorant of artistic technique will hardly be able to imagine. The actual creation of works of art is therefore of value to the average man, not only as an outlet for his emotional energies, but because it enhances his delight in the works of art produced by men whose genius is immeasurably superior to his own. Inasmuch as men live not in solitude, but as members of society, their activities and interests affect not merely themselves, but others too. The value of the enjoyment and creation of works of art as outlets of emotional energies is not restricted to the individual artist or art lover, but on the contrary, possesses a significance which extends to the whole community. Emotion has a natural tendency to express itself. If it can find no outlet on the cultural level, it will sink to the level of the physical and force an outlet there. Should opportunities for constructive expression be denied, then it will seize the first chance of expressing itself destructively. A child who is not encouraged to create will naturally learn to destroy. But destruction doesn't bring the same kind of joy as creation. After a few minutes of savage delight comes a reaction. A feeling of frustration sets in, and eventually the culprit feels even more miserable than he did before indulging in his bout of destructiveness. Many causes of juvenile delinquency and adolescent gangsterism are directly traceable to the fact that neither at home nor in school are sufficient outlets for the emotional energies of youth provided. For nearly all adults, the most frequently used outlet is the lowest and grossest, that of sexual intercourse. Such an outlet the conventions of society quite rightly close to the young and unmarried, but society errs in providing for its younger members insufficient cultural and constructive means of releasing their emotional energies. Education generally places a stronger emphasis on the gaining of knowledge or the acquisition of technical skills than on the cultivation of the emotions. Art is certainly the Cinderella of education. Without going so far as to say that the intellectual and practical aspects of education are its ugly sisters, we do certainly wish to emphasise that if Cinderella is not allowed to go to the ball, she will not stay quietly at home washing the dishes. Probably she will set the house on fire instead. Though the problem of untrained emotion is acutest for adolescents, it is by no means absent from the life of adults, whose predominantly sexual solution is almost as big a confession of failure as the antisocial solution of wayward youth, and in fact is found in one form or another in practically every department of modern life. As Eric Heller's striking image reminds us, the workshops in which our truths are manufactured are surrounded by swarms of unemployed affections. And, as he goes on to warn us, unemployment leads to riots. Not the smallest part of the value of the religion of art is that it restores our individual and social life to order by giving work to our unemployed affections, transforming them from not only lazy and yawning, but positively dangerous drones into singing masons building roofs of gold. The million-tiled golden roofs of the Temple of Beauty. In these days, when all over the world conventional religion so often fails to move the hearts of men, the religion of art may enable some people at least to experience, through the instrumentality of beauty, those supreme values of life which in former centuries were generally mediated by religion. That in its present nascent condition the religion of art can mediate those values as fully and as effectively as the great historic faiths are even now able to do, we would not be justified in claiming. Whether in future it will ever be sufficiently developed so to mediate them, we hesitate to assert. But we believe that our inquiries have revealed no a priori reason why the religion of art should not be able, when consciously developed and utilised as a means of leading the spiritual life, the life of egolessness, to take for many people the place of religion. Not indeed by becoming a Huxleyan substitute, but through its mediation of those values which constitute the very lifeblood of religion truly understood. Indeed, were the claims of the religion of art to be too invidiously weighed against those of conventional religion, in at least one respect the pan of the former would be found preponderating. The religion of art has never preached a holy war or burnt a heretic at the stake, whereas all religions except Buddhism have at one time or another been guilty of some form of persecution. History contains ample justification of Swift's celebrated aphorism that we have just enough religion to make us hate, but not enough to make us love one another. May it never be said that the religion of art has ever tried to stifle the impulse of any noble soul. Conventional religions may be organisationally strong, whereas the religion of art is organisationally weak, but their strength is their greatest weakness, while in its very weakness lies its greatest strength. The religion of art has no temple and no church. Wherever men feel the touch of beauty, there is holy ground. It possesses no scriptures. The whole of nature is its sacred book. It has no priests, for those who enjoy and those who create works of art behold beauty face to face and have no need of any other mediator or intercessor. It has no membership, for the brotherhood of beauty recognize each other at a glance. No fees, for her devotees are prepared to offer the sacrifice of their lives. By its very deficiencies, no less than because of its actual endowments, does the religion of art recommend itself to the hearts and minds of modern men and women. On account of its absolute freedom from institutional and creedal bonds, as much by reason of its irresistible appeal to all that is best and brightest in humanity, is it not only of supreme value to the constantly growing numbers of the creedless and unchurched, but also a useful supplement to the spiritual life of those who can still find in one established religion or another the main sources of their inspiration. Deeply and firmly do we believe that despite its present undeveloped condition, the religion of art is peculiarly fitted to produce, in these troublous days, a kind of character, a type of spiritual personality, which will be the living embodiment of the fact that religion and art are in essence one, and that beauty is not merely truth, but goodness as well.
This concludes the essay, The Religion of Art.